Greetings, my friend.
To a very special mini episode of Gil and Roscoe's Bodacious Horror Podcast. I, as ever, Mr. Roscoe Harold Vacant, am joined once again by my dear friend and most bodacious of colleagues, Mr. Gil Rokitansky. And it's also a great privilege today to be joined by the curator, I think that's probably the term, of the curator.
Or the dungeon keeper, maybe.
Of the Witch's Dungeon Classic Movie Museum in Bristol, Connecticut. And that's Mr. Cortland Hull. Cortland, welcome to Gil and Roscoe's Bodacious Horror Podcast.
Great to be here.
Awesome. Thank you very much for coming on the show.
Yep. It's been a few years.
It's been 3 years. Can you believe that?
No. It doesn't seem possible it's been that long. But a lot has happened in the meantime.
Well, give people a wee bit of context. We interviewed Cortland in 2013, and then in the run up to that season, I actually got the chance to visit the Witch's Dungeon just after Halloween, and Cortland very kindly got the whole place up and running for me, despite the fact that the season had ended, and gave me a wee bit of a tour and left. Gave me a whole lot of different pieces of merchandise that I've still treasure to this day. So, Cortland, thank you very much for that. And this is your 50th anniversary of doing the Witch's Dungeon.
Yes, it seems hard for me to believe because I started it when I was just 13 years old. Of course, most people think I'm older than the pyramids, but that's not true. I just take a lot of tanna leaves. That's how I keep going. But it's something that is my passion. My occupation, I do freelance artwork, and I love doing that. But this is something I've always loved since I was a little boy. And it started jointly with Famous Monsters and building the Aurora model kits when I was a kid of the monsters. But the trouble with that was the model kits were only 8 inches tall. I wanted them life-size. And so that's kind of how it all started.
Fantastic. And obviously, you, a few years ago, released a DVD about the Witch's Dungeon that gives people a chance to see inside the Witch's Dungeon and to get a bit of an idea of your history and the inspirations behind your artwork. Would you like to talk about how you got the idea to start the Witch's Dungeon and obviously give people an idea of what it originally was?
Well, originally, I think it was whenever my folks took me on vacation, if I saw a sign for a wax museum, even if it was an ordinary, and that's what it was back then, just a plain wax museum, but some of them did have a Chamber of Horrors in it, and they'd promote it on the billboards. And my mother said, without me saying anything, well, I know where we're stopping. Because they knew that I was just fascinated. I was a weird little kid. I was only like 7 or 8 years old, and I was just fascinated with wax museums. And so we would go to them no matter where we were, but it always disappointed me because the Chamber of Horrors, I expected to see the Frankenstein monster, the Phantom of the Opera, the Wolfman, some of the classic movie characters. Yeah. Nothing. It was just Jack the Ripper and torture devices and the Spanish Inquisition and things like that. It had nothing to do with the classic movie monsters. And I was always disappointed because that's what I wanted to see. There were a few, very, very few, that once in a while you'd see one that maybe had the Frankenstein monster or maybe had Dracula in it, but that was very rare. So even from as a young boy, I thought, well, there should be some museum that's devoted just to the classic movie monsters and the actors and the makeup that made them so memorable for us. And that's kind of where the idea came about. You have to realize in 1966, when I started this, Halloween was not what it is now. Halloween was nothing more than paper cutouts that you'd put around the house and bobbing for apples and maybe a masquerade party and trick-or-treating. That was it. And it only happened on Halloween weekend. It wasn't the entire month of October. Now, Halloween has become the second most popular holiday other than Christmas. And, of course, and I think we probably consider it more important than Christmas, but that's
Absolutely, absolutely.
Well, I don't, nobody ever gets me a Halloween present.
But they should.
They should.
We should have black and white striped socks on the fireplace that should have Halloween presents in them.
Well, actually, my girlfriend and I did decorate a Christmas tree in Halloween. Well, we thought we'll get Halloween colors, and we went to shops, and now you can buy Halloween tinsel and Halloween Christmas, well, lights, and so many tree decorations that are Halloween themed. Because,
well, you know, here's a great idea for you, at least I think it is. It kind of came from some of the set design that I've done in the new Witch's Dungeon, is that get yourself a really kind of gnarly tree branch, a good size one, paint it all black, completely black, bring it into the house, and hang Halloween decorations from it.
Well, we have it on a Christmas tree because one of the things I'm lacking now, since we had a tiny baby daughter 14 months ago, is space for storage.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you very much. But she's an incredible little bundle of fun, and we decided that the Christmas tree, we've only got a small one, so it stays out all year round now, and we decorate it differently based on seasons or whatever popular holidays are on. So this month it's all Halloween stuff, and it was unbelievably easy to buy decorations for a Halloween tree. I thought it would be difficult.
Absolutely. That's great.
Over here, it didn't used to be as kind of corporate, maybe
Halloween,
even 15 years ago.
Yeah, very, very recently, Halloween's kind of become far more akin to the American version of Halloween. It's, as you say, only very recently that's came over here, and I think it's brilliant.
It's brilliant in one way, but also I do miss the homemade costumes. Because when I was a kid, I always put a lot of effort into my costumes. Like, if I went out as Judge Dredd once, and I made a full helmet out of paper mache, and I used a pin to make tiny holes in it so that I could actually see through the visor, but that nobody else could see back through.
Oh, that's great. That's just that, unfortunately, that they have now Halloween shops all across the country, and it kind of makes it so easy to just buy a costume, but the creativity really comes from when you make a costume.
Yeah.
And lots of times making a costume, it's more elaborate than it would be if you just bought one, because they're prefabricated, you know, they're mass produced. And you know, one costume which I think would be great to do, did you guys ever see the Disney version of the Scarecrow of Romney Marsh?
No, I haven't, but I will be able to check it out because I have been on a Disney kick.
Dr. Sin, S-Y-N, Dr. Sin. It was done by, it was played by Patrick McGoohan, and it's one of my favorite Disney movies, and it's really good. But the character that Disney created of the Scarecrow Romney Marsh, which is played by Patrick McGoohan, the mask, the whole outfit of it, It looks like a walking scarecrow, but I mean a very ominous one. And that's why I'm surprised that they haven't done more with that character, because it's really a great character. Eventually, I'd like to make a life-size figure of that.
Oh, my goodness. I've just Googled that, Cortland. It is quite the image.
It is. It's really great.
Very striking.
I love. Yeah. It's rather... terrifying in a way, you know. And to think that Disney came up with it—that's unusual.
Certainly is.
But of course, basically the same story was done by Hammer Films back in the '60s. It was called Night Creatures, but it was similar to this book that they both based it upon. But oddly enough, the Hammer film didn't have a key character as good as what Disney did, which is unusual because Hammer generally went all out with their characters. But they did have horses dressed with capes on them that looked like skeletons.
Oh, that
which
looks.
was,
I can see it
that
just
was
now.
great.
Yeah, that looks brilliant.
Yeah, that
Yeah.
scarecrow design, I've just looked it up as well, and that. I was thinking I'll watch this with the baby, but maybe
Yeah, probably
not.
not. Did you ever see Courtland any of the Blind Dead series?
The Blind Dead?
Yeah.
Yeah, the one the Spanish that was Spanish, wasn't it?
Yeah, because they've
Yeah.
got the skeleton horses and they've got this really
Yes,
great
yes.
zombified effect.
Those are really pretty eerie. They're very good. Yeah.
So, Cortland, going back a wee bit, I mean, obviously speaking about great character design, one of the first characters that you designed yourself was Zenobia, the gypsy witch, who is the character who is on all of the publicity materials for the Witch's Dungeon, all of the posters, and she also greets you and when you enter the Witch's Dungeon. So I wondered if you could tell us a bit about that and about the voices behind that.
Well, it's interesting how it came about. First of all, I didn't want to do your typical witch with the pointed hat and the black, completely black outfit. As a little kid, as I say, I was weird, but that's not unusual.
You're in the right company
always,
here.
I was always fascinated by arcades where they had gypsy fortune tellers that you put a dime in and the hand would move and a fortune would come out the bottom. And but they were too pretty looking. I wanted a witch looking like that, and so that's where the germ of the idea came from. I didn't want a common witch with a pointed hat. I wanted a gypsy witch, and so that's where the idea for Zenobia came from. The name came from, oddly enough, my mom, because a student that she was with when she was in grade school was rather obnoxious, and she says her name was Zenobia. And that's where the name came from, was from my mother's classmate that was a rather obnoxious girl that had the name of Zenobia.
That's fantastic. And one of the interesting things about Zenobia is the person who obviously voiced the character.
Absolutely, yes. Ever since I was a little kid, one of my favorite cartoons of all time was Trick or Treat with Donald Duck, and then later the Bugs Bunny cartoon with Witch Hazel. Both characters were oddly enough called Witch Hazel, the one in Trick or Treat and the one in the Bugs Bunny cartoons, and the voice was the same. It was June Foray that was the voice of the witch in those cartoons, and she is best known as the voice of Rocky the Flying Squirrel and Natasha and Granny and a number of other ones. So at first I didn't know June, but I did know Mae Questel. Mae Questel was the voice of Betty Boop and Olive Oil, and she only lived down in New York, so it wasn't that far for me. So I happened to be visiting her one time, and I said, "You know, I really would love to have an original recording that I could use for my witch, Zenobia." And I said, "I know you have done the sea hag in the Popeye cartoons." This was Mae Questel did the sea hag. And she said, "Oh, I don't do a very good witch voice. You should have June Foray." Well, I said, "I don't know June." And Mae Questel said, "Well, she's the best friend of mine." She says, "I'll call her up." So right then and there, she called up June Foray, who lives on the West Coast. And I talked to June, and as they say, the rest was history. We've been friends ever since. And June did a number of recordings for me as Zenobia, the Gypsy Witch. And she just celebrated a few weeks ago her 99th birthday.
Oh,
That's
that's a
incredible. My
milestone.
goodness. So she's still with us, thank goodness. And also, Another character that a lot of people don't realize, but if you're a fan of the Twilight Zone, she was the voice of Talky Tina.
Yes, the video, the DVD that you've provided, that obviously that you've that we bought from you is the Witch's Dungeon, has this great section about talking Tina and about June's experience of that. It's really interesting to hear her speaking about that.
Well, because the reason she was chosen, and it was Rod Serling himself that chose her to do the voice of Talky Tina, was because June was the voice of a doll that was very popular back in the 60s called Chatty Cathy.
Ah.
So Talky Tina was the dark side of Chatty Cathy.
Is that where that term comes from? Because
yeah.
At the moment with my little tiny daughter being 14 months old, we keep calling her a bit of a Chatty Cathy.
So see, if you think of the two names, Chatty Cathy, Talky Tina, see, you get the connection.
That's awesome.
That's really cool. Everything's linked up tonight.
It is indeed. So, Cortland, you know, we've spoke about a wee bit about the Witch's Dungeon as it previously stood. It was actually it started out as being a relatively small chalet, a small but long chalet type building in your back garden.
So that's what I had originally wanted when my dad built it. I wanted it to look sort of like a little gingerbread house, so that's why we did it sort of in a Swiss chalet style. But I grew out of it after a number of years, but the dilemma was where to put it, because we were in it was located on my property, but it was a residential area, and that was part of the problem. Also, a part of the problem was that there were all sorts of regulations that had come about after we had created it, and we thought it would have been grandfathered in, but in Connecticut, that's not necessarily so. So I was in a real dilemma as to what to do. Finally, luckily, the Chamber of Commerce, I talked to them, and they said, well, we don't want to see it leave Connecticut, because I was considering moving it to New York, the New York area, just outside of New York, and sort of near the Sleepy Hollow area of New York. But they did talk to the Bristol Historical Society, and they welcomed us with open arms, and so now it is 3 times larger than when you actually visited the original one. And there's many more figures than what I had originally, about double the amount of figures, and I've even added 2 more this year. So it's been wonderful also because I can now put on, in display cases, I can put on display a lot of the original props that were too delicate to put on display before. Now they're in glass cases and everybody can enjoy them. Like, for instance, the original Exorcist head, one of the two in existence of the Exorcist head of Linda Blair from the film. I have, we just recently restored the little big man head that Dick Smith did for the movie with Dustin Hoffman. And we have the Frankenstein head that he did for a publicity photo with Boris Karloff for the Saturday Evening Post. And then there's John Chambers makeups from both Beneath the Planet of the Apes and the original Planet of the Apes.
Wow.
We have one of the Close Encounters aliens and one of the Mars Attacks heads and one of the Golden Idols, one of the 4 original Golden Idols that were used in the movie Raiders of the Lost Ark. And just recently, Bill Diamond loaned us one of Indiana Jones's hat and
his whip.
Whips. The whip, yeah. And so there's a lot more to see now because you get to see a lot of the original movie memorabilia that I had in the collection, but no real way to display it before.
And to give people an idea, each figure is presented in a scene that's representative of the film that they're from. for the most part, within the well within the original Witch's Dungeon. Is that, I take it, that's been preserved, Cortland?
Oh, it's even much more elaborate
Wow.
now. Like, for instance, Dracula now has a full castle facade behind him, with an archway and everything. And the creature from the Black Lagoon, it's the full standing 6'3" creature with an entire tropical foliage behind him. And the Phantom of the Opera has a pipe organ with him. We've added the Beast from La Belle et la Bête, the French film, one of my all-time favorite fantasy films. Very elaborate. And just recently, as a matter of fact, for this weekend, I've added Lon Chaney Jr. as the Wolfman because, of course, for many years I've had my great uncle Henry Hull as the Werewolf of London, which was the very first movie werewolf in feature films. But I had the Wolfman a long time ago because I had made him. Well, the one I had originally made, Universal Studios Florida bought him from me. So the one that you see at the Classic Monsters Cafe down at Universal Florida was our original Wolfman that we had here. So I have the pieces to do a new one, but I just never got around to it. We didn't have enough extra space, so I decided we ought to bring them back. So now the Wolfman is on display as well as the Werewolf of London.
That's fantastic. I know.
I
So,
really want to go.
and one of the kind of big thrills that I had when I was there was, you also had at that time you had a Boris Karloff as Dr. Neiman.
Well, in the new place, we have him. Don't forget, he takes on the persona of Professor Lampini, which he
Ah,
killed
yes.
and took over his Chamber of Horrors. And so we have Professor Lampini, a.k.a. Dr. Nieman, Boris Karloff, with the skeleton of Count Dracula with a stake in its heart.
Fantastic.
So we've got that whole display now. And I don't know if you remember in House of Frankenstein, there was this very elaborate poster in the background, which you didn't see too much, but I loved it. So I recreated that poster. I hand-painted it, and we have that behind him, the one that says Professor Lampini in his traveling chamber of horrors, and below it says, "See the actual skeleton of Count Dracula." So I hand-painted the poster and recreated it, so it's behind the whole scene with Professor Lampini and the skeleton.
If people are interested, you can actually find, if you do a search for Professor Lampini, it's actually one of the first things that comes up in Google image search as your Lampini slash Neiman and the poster that you've just described, and it looks fantastic.
Oh, great, great.
So that's
Yeah,
amazing.
and as a matter of fact, if they go to Wikipedia, there's a number of really good photos that we put in at Wikipedia for the Witch's Dungeon Classic Movie Museum. We updated the photos that are in there, so you can see some of the new ones. It's not all the figures, but it's some of them.
That's fantastic. So, obviously, Cortland, you're now part of the Bristol Historical Society. You're based there. When are you guys going to be open this year? And how can people come along and see the show?
Well, right now we're open the entire month of October, every weekend, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, 7 p.m. till 10 p.m. The exception is we're also open Halloween night, which is October 31st on Monday. And that night, our special guest is going to be Boris Karloff's daughter, Sarah Karloff.
Now, Sarah Karloff, that's fantastic. Sarah Karloff was obviously has always been a huge proponent of the Witch's Dungeon and has spoken very favorably about the Witch's Dungeon in public, as has Ron Chaney. Would you like to say something about the continued relationship that you've had with Sarah over the years?
Oh, yes. Sarah and I, we first met actually at Forry Ackerman's house. My goodness, that was like 1970, I believe, something like that. I was about 15 at the time, I think. And so we've known each other a long time. She's always been very, very supportive. And then, of course, through Sarah, I got to know the Lugosi family and the Cheney family. But I had known Vincent Price even before that because my great uncle Henry Hull had appeared with Vincent in a movie called Master of the World. So Vincent was another one that was very, very supportive from way back, him and Sarah both. As a matter of fact, just 2 weeks ago, we had Vincent's daughter, Victoria Price, was here. And I have to tell you, in a way, it was kind of emotional for both of us because, of course, I think I've told you before, Vincent Price did voice recordings just for The Witch's Dungeon, which at the time especially was a thrill for me because I wrote this dialogue, and to have Vincent record it for me was such a treat, you know. So when she went through with me on the tour, she was just, you could just tell it was a very unique feeling for her going through hearing her dad's voice and the figures that I'd done. It was a wonderful, wonderful night. So that was, it was a thrill for me to have Victoria here.
That's fantastic. And the we'll obviously play a clip of the introduction to the Witch's
Yeah, I
Dungeon.
sent you an outtake. He makes a mistake on that.
Oh wow. Oh
I
fantastic.
thought it would be, I thought it would be fun for you to play that because he does a little flub on there, and you'll see what he says afterward. He actually realizes it, and it's funny.
Oh,
So.
that's brilliant. I can't wait to hear that, Corland.
There's
That's
so
awesome.
many names dropping in this episode. Have you noticed that?
I have
Forrest
noticed.
Ackerman.
So, I mean, obviously, that's something that's worth discussing in and of itself. Cortland, is obviously your relationship with Forry, the late great Forry Ackerman. How did you get to know Forry, and what was how was he how
Well,
what role did he play in the Witch's Dungeon story?
that's really quite interesting how it happened. It was kind of by chance that my, see, I had a rare blood condition as a kid, and my folks wanted to do anything they could to help me get an interest in the arts and film and like that, because they knew that as far as any other things like sports, that was not in the picture. So they knew I loved Famous Monsters magazine. So we were going out to California. We were going to meet with John Chambers anyway, because I knew him through my great uncle Henry Hull, and we had other connections and so forth. But we thought that I should go to try to see Forrey. So we contacted him ahead of time. We were able to call him, and he was very hospitable. And he introduced me to Don Post Sr. and Vern Langan. And it w he loved the idea that I wanted to create a museum that was honoring the classic films as well as the actors and the makeup artists. And so did Don Post Sr. loved that idea, and as well as Vern Langan. So these people, I couldn't have asked for better. It was an unusual time. It could never happen now. It was just kind of magical in a way that how it all came about. Very fortunate. I was very, very fortunate. And everybody just wanted to be a part of it and help me.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, with the Don Post element, that's again someone who's played an integral role in the kind of the story of the kind of story of horror fandom, I suppose. And the same with the Aurora Monsters as well, which you've obviously covered in a bit of depth, with your documentary on that topic. I wondered if that was something that you would want to speak about obviously getting. I know a lot of people are going to be reaching for the John Zakerley records in this season. So, what was it like to do that, and what was what would you like to say about that DVD?
Well, when I did the Aurora Monsters documentary, I knew that I needed to have someone host it because I wanted to also create the fun it was when I was a kid, during what I guess you would call the monster craze. And so I had already known John Zacherle, of course, Zacherle the Cool Ghoul. And so I approached John if he would be willing to host it. And he loved the idea. And we had him co-host it actually with a puppet creature a character that Bill Diamond created. Bill Diamond had worked for Jim Henson and the Muppets, and he had this character by the name of Gorgo the Gargoyle. And so they worked beautifully together, and Bill and I created these atmospheres for Zach, and Zach was like a kid in a candy store because he said he never had such elaborate sets or props in his TV show when he used to host Shock Theater back in the 50s and into the well into the 60s. So it was fun for him as well, and we had all these gadgets for him, and of course we had the my Frankenstein monster on the slab that he was experimenting with. So it was a very, very fun shoot to put this together. And I wrote a script for him, but I have to tell you, Zach was very improvisational. And he would come up with things that were funnier than what I wrote. So I had to rewrite on the set because what he came up with was even better, but we'd have to do reshoots of certain sections. So I had to write it up for him what he did. But that was one of the most fun things I ever did was having Zachary the Cool Ghoul host our Aurora Monsters DVD. And I have to say, before people start looking for it, it's out of print right now. We will be reissuing it, we hope, sometime around Christmas, that we will have that available. And also the other documentary that we did on Phantom of the Opera called Unmasking the Masterpiece. Both of those we hope to have available sometime in December.
Now, we previously discussed that with yourself in a bit more detail, and it again is a really interesting, very personal reflection on your love of Phantom of the Opera, going from as you mentioned, being unwell as a child and then finding this character that you really identified with. So yeah, absolutely. So I take it as the Witch's Dungeon DVD still in print just now?
The Witch's Dungeon DVD is still available. That's the Witch's Dungeon 40 Years of Chills. And you can get it through you can contact us through our website, which is preservehollywood.org. That's all one word, preservehollywood.org. And they can also get all the information about the Witch's Dungeon. And there are a couple of clips on there as well for people to look at. So they get a little insight into what it's like.
So you must have quite a few things that are donated now, just people go out of their way to say, this should be with you. Is there
Oh, absolutely.
anything that you
Absolutely.
really wish would come your way? Is there that one thing that you're really, really waiting on?
Well, it'd be tough to say because unfortunately, most of the stuff I'd really want the most was back in the past, and sadly, many of those items, they were just tossed away, sadly, by the studios because they didn't think it was worth anything at the time, or they finished the picture, they were done with it, they didn't need it. What I would love, but I'm not sure if it exists, but I think it might. I believe the headpiece that was in Return of the Fly might still exist. That I love the looks of that. I also would love the actual wax head that was of Charles Bronson that was in House of Wax, because the last close-up in the movie shows that head of Charles Bronson because he played Igor, the deaf mute and House of Wax with Vincent Price. I mean, there are other things, but those are the two that come to mind because I always kind of like the Return of the Fly, that enormous fly head that they had in the remake or the sequel. I mean, that
Yeah,
they did
it was really oversized, that one.
it was, but there was something really creepy about it, especially when I was a kid and saw it. That one was a little unnerving as a kid when you saw it. Of
So,
course, the one thing I would love to have, but I'm sure that they went to the dumpster years and years ago, was, didn't you love those gigantic ants in Them?
oh, yes.
Yeah.
I'm not sure where I'd put them because they're the size of a
Yeah.
Volkswagen, but.
The one thing about the fly that really affected me when I was a kid was his voice at the end.
Oh, yes. Oh, I
It
got to tell you a
offended
little
me.
story about that because I did an interview with David Hedison, which is going to be on an upcoming documentary that we're doing called The Classic Chillers of the Silver Screen. David Hedison was telling me that when he recorded the voice at the end, he did it in his best Shakespearean voice, you know, help me, help me. You know, he was doing it very dramatically. Then he goes to the theater, has no idea what they were going to do. And he's sitting in the theater, and here comes this voice. He says, like Alvin and the Chipmunks. And
Help
he
me,
says,
help me,
yes.
help me.
And he says, I wanted to hide under the seat. And he says, I thought, oh my God, what have they done? And he says, I couldn't believe it. You could hear a pin drop in the theater. It just unnerved people. And he says, I would never have thought it would have had that effect. And he says, now it's probably the piece of dialogue I'm best known for.
Well, it wouldn't have worked if it had just been his voice, though, would it? Because if they'd heard anything, they'd have gone, "Oh, I can hear him." They wouldn't
Because he
have.
was so tiny, yeah, it
Yeah.
probably wouldn't have worked that way, and that's probably what the director or the producer thought, that it needed to be high pitched so that it would seem like it was a little tiny fly, you know.
Yeah.
But so it's funny how at first you think something is going to be a disaster, and then it becomes one of the most popular things that you've ever done. And that's what David said. He couldn't believe it. He's a very nice guy, by the way, and a great sense of humor. I mean, you have to understand, as a kid, one of my favorite shows was Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea. And I couldn't believe that on several film conventions I've done, David wants to be right next to me so that he can, because I've done a life-size figure of him as the fly, and he loves being next to it so he can have pictures taken with his fans, you know, as the fly. And it's just a thrill for me to have Captain Crane talking to me in between, you know, from Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea. Very nice guy. And he told me one funny story. He said that when The Fly first came out, I think he said it was a New York paper that says, Vincent Price opens Fly in New York, the biggest thing we've ever seen.
Brilliant.
Of course, younger listeners will know him better as Felix from the Bond movies.
Oh yeah, Felix Leiter from the
Yep,
Bond films,
that's.
right? Yes, he was in one of the Timothy Dalton films, and I think one with Roger Moore, if I'm not mistaken. Yes, he was in Live and Let
Live
Die,
and
I
Let
believe.
Die and License to Kill was the Timothy
License
Dalton
to
one.
Kill,
Yep.
that's the one, yeah. And he said he loved doing the Bond films. He says the production company for the Bond films, he says they were very, very nice to work with. He really enjoyed doing them. But so anyway, getting back to the Witch's Dungeon 50th anniversary, as I mentioned, we have so much more on display than what we ever did before, and the sets are more elaborate, as I mentioned. We also have added another section. After you've taken the complete tour, then you're guided into the auditorium area where we run real film, not video, but actual movies,
Oh,
all
wow.
night from 7 p.m. till 10 p.m. And in that room, we have lighted cabinets where we have memorabilia from the 1960s and 70s, toys, games, model kits from the monster craze era. And we have everything from creepy crawlers to puzzles to mechanical figures that came out of the Frankenstein monster and everything you can imagine from the 1960s.
I'd imagine there's a few classic Pez heads in there as well, then.
Yes, and a number of great things that you probably didn't even know they came out with at that time, and then some of the little tiny Remco figures that they did, and there's this one. Well, some of this stuff, well, like say for instance, Creepy Crawlers. That machine got so hot, the original one. You could never sell that today because a kid would burn themselves on the plates. But the other thing that they would never sell today, they had a Frankenstein styrofoam ball toss, and there's all these really sharp plastic pointed spikes
Oh my
that are
goodness.
tough. And if little Timmy didn't like little Johnny could end up looking like Pinhead.
Actually,
So,
that's one thing that just you mentioning Pinhead there. Are there any modern horror, iconic images that you think this would fit in with the Witch's Dungeon, or do you prefer to just stay classic?
I prefer to stay. I think my cutoff is somewhere in the 70s because, Dr. Fibes is probably the most recent one that we have in there, the Abominable Dr. Fibes of Vincent Price, which is probably one of my all-time favorite Vincent Price movies. Even though it's tongue-in-cheek, I just love it. And it's the way Vincent played it, you know.
I love it as well. It is a great film.
Am I right in thinking that your mother was involved with designing the costume that you use for Dr. Fibes?
That's correct. All the costumes, most of them, were done by my mom. My mom recreated not only the Dr. Fibes outfit, but the most elaborate one she probably did was the Red Death from the Phantom of the Opera, the Chaney Red Death, Mask of the Red Death. But she also did one that we haven't done a figure for because I do want to enter more into classic sci-fi. She did a beautiful costume of Ming the Merciless from the original Buster Crabbe Flash Gordon. So eventually, I want to do a figure of Charles Middleton as Ming the Merciless and Buster Crabbe as Flash Gordon.
So is that that's the outfit that's figured that is in the documentary where there's a sequence where Ming meets
Oh yes,
Abbott and
that's the
Costello.
costume. Right. Yeah, that's the costume that I want to make a figure with.
Oh wow.
As you can see, she did a beautiful job on that outfit.
Yeah, absolutely.
So recently, because one of them that I always wanted to do was Jean Marais as the Beast from La Belle et la Bête, I found a lady that has been working with me. Her name is Audrey Wellner, and she, like my mom, had done theatrical costumes in the past. My mom had done some work on Broadway, but she understood the basic mechanics of how to make these elaborate costumes, and she's the one that did the Beast costume. And she's right now working feverishly on Artith Bay to add. We wanted to get this in before Sarah comes on Halloween weekend. So he's going to be the most recent one, Artith Bay from The Mummy. Not Imhotep, but Artith Bay, the character that wears the fez on the top,
Yeah.
you know.
Also, Artith Bay looks far cooler than the mummy.
Also, far creepier.
I think so.
Just the way
So
the skin goes.
Yeah.
Yeah, the whole costume is done in velvets, but very subdued colors of green and gold. But they look like they're old, the velvet that we have for it. And Audrey is doing a beautiful, beautiful job of it. Also, he's wearing an exact replica of the Scarab brain, too. In his other hand, he'll be holding the Scroll of Thoth.
I was going to ask you, rings, Cortland. Do you have a Dracula ring?
Yes, I have one of the identical one to what Christopher Lee wore in his Dracula film, starting with Dracula Has Risen from the Grave. From that point on, he had gotten a ring from Flory Ackerman. It was cast in white gold, and there were only two, and I got the other one. So those two rings are very unique because they're in white gold. And when I got to meet Christopher Lee several years back, this was 1999, I think it was. That was when we did the interview for the Witch's Dungeon documentary.
Mm.
I had my ring with me, and I kind of treasure this. I have a picture of Christopher Lee wearing my ring, the Dracula ring.
That's fantastic.
So I'll have to send that to you so you can have it if you want to show it.
That's awesome.
I would make that the cover art for this episode.
So that was a thrill, and I have it on video, although we never actually used it. We were talking about the ring, and you know, he said, you know, it's identical with the one that Fari gave him, and he said that he wore it in honor of Bela Lugosi. That's why he wore the film, the ring in his films later on, because it was sort of a tribute to Bela. So I thought that was very nice that he did that.
Absolutely, and obviously we've just again spoken to Frank Della Stretto, Cortland. I don't know if you're aware of any of Frank's.
Yeah. I know Frank very well, yeah.
Mm. Well, speaking to Frank about he's just written this great book, which is about Abbott and Costello meet. Well, the book is about his time growing up in the 50s and 60s, watching TV reruns, and it's just a very personal reflection on his experience of watching horror and growing up in horror. And it, you know, it brought to mind a lot of the kind of influences that were coming through in your documentary as well, and the, you know, the stories that you tell about your passion, and yeah, it was really great just to get the chance to speak to Frank about that. And his book, I don't know if you've read it, about Bela Lugosi, it specifically focuses on his time in the UK. So it splits its time between the three films that he made in the 30s and then his stage tour of the UK with Dracula. And it's just this really fascinating book that delves into, I mean, obviously the story of those tours was that they were a complete failure. But in actual fact, Frank's research tells a very different story.
Yeah, Frank does great research on his books. He really puts out wonderful work, and I felt very honored that Frank loved the artwork that I did so much. We talked earlier about the Professor Lampini poster. He wanted to use it in one of his books. I don't know which one he's using it in, but he wanted me to give him a scan of the artwork because there was no photograph of that poster available, and it was never in a lobby card or anything like that. So see, what I had to do was I had to do freeze frames from the movie and kind of piece it together because they never show it all in one shot. Mm-hmm. Then I had to redraw it and repaint it. That was the only way to do it. You just couldn't do it any other way. And so Frank liked that piece, so I was very honored that he wanted to put it in one of his books.
I would imagine that would be a quaint and curious volume of forgotten lore, which is his kind of his book, which goes into his various films that he talks about. So he's done three books. So I'd imagine it would be that one. But that's really awesome. That's fantastic. And
it's really cool that you've kind of rescued that image
that's yeah.
Never really been seen.
No, you don't really. Unless you're really looking for it. It's in the scene with George Zucco where he talks about how he acquired the skeleton of Count Dracula. And he points up to the poster, but you never see it too well. You only see the camera sort of travels up to it, but you never see it all in one shot. That was was why I had to kind of piece it together from several different freeze frames that I did from the film.
Yeah. I mean, it's a brilliant film. I have sadly not seen it for a couple of years now, and I'm really wanting to watch it again at the moment.
House of Frankenstein is a lot of fun. The only thing I have to say, and nothing against John Carradine, I love John Carradine, but I've always thought, isn't it a shame that Bela didn't get to play Dracula in that
absolutely,
one?
Absolutely, absolutely. And that's really the only thing that lets it down.
Yeah.
I've always found that one to be really great fun, and yeah, one of my favorite Universal horrors. But
I love it. It is a lot. But can you imagine what it would have been like for Boris Karloff to pull out that stake and it turns into Bela?
Absolutely,
that would have been tremendous. You know, and the two of them confronting each other—that would have been great.
Was there a contractual issue or something, Cortland? Do you know?
I think. I'm only guessing. Now, Frank probably would know the story far better than I would. I'm just guessing that possibly because there was a problem with Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman, but it wasn't Bela's fault. It was because they originally wrote it that it was obviously a sequel to Ghost of Frankenstein, and the monster was supposed to be blind, and he was supposed to have Igor's voice, because that's how it ended in Ghost of Frankenstein. So Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman was the direct sequel to that. Well, then midstream, Universal, this I do know, they changed ideas, and they decided to drop the idea that the monster was blind, and they didn't want to use Igor's voice. So therefore, a lot of scenes were still in the picture that Bela had performed as if he was supposed to be blind. And so it gave his performance a rather lackluster look. I mean, it wasn't Bela's fault, but it was the recutting of the film and the reshaping of it during production, see? So all I can think of, and this just is guesswork on my part, because that film was 1943, I believe, and House of Frankenstein was 44. Possibly they didn't want to use Bela because of that. I don't know. I can't say for sure, but...
I actually just watched Return of the Vampire, which, interestingly enough, was 43. So I was kind of wondering whether that was something to do with it. It's one of those kind of interesting things.
You know, some of the studios were very rival-like, and maybe they didn't like that Bela played basically Dracula in a non-Universal film.
Absolutely.
Even though they did not use the name Dracula, they couldn't, because at that time Universal had the sole rights to the name, to the character of Dracula. That was why Columbia had to call him Armand Tesler instead of Count Dracula. But let's face it, for all accounts and purposes, it's Bela playing Dracula.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Okay, so, Cortland, obviously people can come along. We're going to get this episode out good and quick so that we can give you as much publicity as possible for the season that's coming up. Obviously, as well as your events up until October, am I right in thinking that you're running events throughout the year? Is that still happening?
What we do is when we can't have the Witch's Dungeon open, we do a film series twice a month, and it's actually shown on real film, and we show various classic films with cartoons or sometimes with episodes of Flash Gordon. And that's what we do during the rest of the year. The unfortunate thing is that because... in order to have the Witch's Dungeon open, it has to be, of course, handicapped accessible. Well, the Historical Society does want us to move up to the second floor, and then we could be open all year round. But the problem is they do not have an elevator. So until an elevator can be installed, we can't really officially be open all year round. So what they do during the month of October, and this is a major undertaking for both of us, the Historical Society stores all of their displays in storerooms during, this happens the last week of September, and then we bring everything in and set it up, and we only have roughly about 4.5 days to set this up. And that's not easy. We work practically round the clock that whole week to do that, which it would be so much nicer if it could be permanent and we could have it open all year round. That's what we're working for. It's just a matter of getting the funding to get that elevator put in, and then we'll be on the second floor, and then people can visit us all year round.
Fantastic.
Well,
And
hopefully that'll happen soon.
that's brilliant. And obviously the move from your original location to Bristol was a massive step forward and something that you were talking about 3 years ago as well. So it's great to see that the Witch's Dungeon is, after 50 years, still flourishing, and going from strength to strength.
And
Does it
larger
feel
than it
like
was
50 years?
before. I'm sorry, what?
Does it feel like 50 years?
Oh, not at all. I mean, you don't have to do a lot in mathematics to figure I was 13 when it started, and it's 50 years later. That's all I'll say. But I do not feel that age at all. I still feel like a kid because, as Sarah Karloff has said to me, she says, "You're like Peter Pan. This museum keeps you young." And I think it's true. It does. And because of the fact that I feel that we're bringing this to new generations that maybe wouldn't know about these films. And see, there's this stigma about, oh, those movies are in black and white. I don't want to see them. But if you see them as you have when you visited, you see them three-dimensionally in full color with a background set. It's almost like you stepped onto the set when they made the movie. And more so now with the more elaborate sets that we have, that this is something that people, even younger people, get excited about. And many of them say afterward, gee, I want to get that DVD. I want to see that movie. Because they didn't have that feeling before. They see there's more to it than what they thought. And because of our tour guides, we now have two live tour guides. And I've been told we're probably the only wax museum around that still has live tours. And the way I designed it was that I figure most of these movies that we have in the Witch's Dungeon were done in black and white. And we're presenting them in full color with colored lighting and dramatic effect with the lighting. So I thought, well, the tour guides, since they're the only live people in there, they should be completely black and white. So their makeup and their costumes are all black and white. So we have Carmilla Karnstein, that is your first host. She takes you halfway through the museum. And then the second host is Farnsworth the butler, and he does the last half of it. And each of them do a fantastic job. It's like live theater. They do it a bit over the top, sort of like how Vincent Price did his tours of House of Wax.
Yeah, I would love to have been on that too.
Yes, you need to see it. You really should. It's a lot of fun, and people come back several times during the season to see it, even if they're in New York or wherever. I know in the past 3 years, see, we didn't really keep a track of it years ago, but just in the past 3 years, since we moved to the Historical Society, we've had visitors from 17 different countries,
Wow.
from 25 states, and over 50 communities in the Connecticut area.
That's fantastic. That's amazing.
And what I like about it
Really?
is that the displays will mean a lot to people that are already familiar with these films. But to go and see something that looks as awesome as, because people can go and have a look online and they'll get a little tiny glimpse of what it looks like, but nothing like actually being there. But people who aren't familiar with the films that go along and see all of the objects and get to take the tour, they
Oh,
might
yeah,
then go away
sure.
and decide, I'm going to get that Universal Monsters box set that I saw in the shop and
Yeah.
discover some classic films. But then they won't be seeing the films as black and white because they've already seen your colorized version.
Something that everybody that's come through has enjoyed. And as I say, it's really like, in a way, three different museums because you've got the display of original movie props that were actually used in films and makeups from films. Then you've got the Wax Museum tour. And then when you come in to see the movies, which run all night long, then you get to see some of the memorabilia from the 60s and 70s of the toys and games and all so forth. So it's a lot to see, and it's just a mere $6 donation, and that's a whole night's entertainment.
And Cortland, what films have you been running? Obviously, when I was at your, I don't know if I'm allowed to say, but when I was at your house, there were more than a few film canisters lying around your house. So obviously, they've been transferred to the Witch's Dungeon.
Yeah,
So what films are you playing?
we've been like last weekend we showed the Chaney Phantom of the Opera and Nosferatu, and this weekend we'll probably show. I think we were going to show. We try to show some unusual ones that people haven't seen much, like the Vampire Bat with Fay Wray, and a couple other more unique ones that people don't commonly get to see, you know.
Very cool. That's really great. And you're as well as that, you're going to conventions, I believe, and doing taking the
Well,
display with you.
I'm not doing it this October.
Okay.
Because I felt I should be there every weekend, and I didn't want to take any figures out. But during the year, yes, I do conventions. I generally do the Chiller Show in New York, or I'm sorry, New Jersey. That's in Parsippany, New Jersey, and then I do Monster Bash, which is in Pittsburgh, and I do Wonderfest, which is in Louisville, Kentucky. And several other ones that I've done, Super Mega Fest, which is in Boston. So I do several shows a year, and we bring three or four of our life-size figures to those shows.
I think
But
Monster
as
Bash is the
far
one that we would love to go to.
as
That's obviously the big one, the one that we would love to attend at some point.
But doesn't Super Mega Fest just sound even better? It's just got that
Well,
name though, Super Mega Fest. You think, what are you going to call it? Oh, well, we could call it Great Fest. What about Really Good Fest? What about Mega Fest? What about Super Mega Fest?
I think you would really, you guys, especially with what you like, that you'd enjoy Monster Bash or Wonderfest, because Wonderfest is basically a model show. I mean, you know, classic models, but they have newer garage kits that they have pretty amazing stuff, and they have scratch-built models that they have at that show. But they also have guests, you know, like they have people from Lost in Space and people like Greg Nicotero, the makeup artist, that come. And but then Monster Bash is basically about the classic horror films, both Universal and Hammer. So they have a great show too. I love doing those two shows in particular. But Chiller's terrific too, because they have an enormous amount of guests that go to that show, and people that you never think you'd get a chance to see. In the past, they've had people, of course, he's passed away since then, but I was thrilled to go to that show and see Robert Culp. They have really unusual guests that show up at Chiller Theater. So they're all great shows. They really are. But I was going to say, for me, the most exciting thing is this year that the Witch's Dungeon is going to be honored for the second time by Ripley's Believe It or Not. That doesn't happen very often. This will be on Halloween Day, October 31st. They'll have an article in Ripley's Believe It or Not about the Witch's Dungeon 50th anniversary.
Fantastic. So, but obviously, we spoke before Cortland about a Ripley style article about Henry Hull that was later corrected. Is that correct? And obviously, this is another opportunity for you to get a mention.
Oh yeah, well, I have to say, I don't know if you get him over there, but in this country we have Svengoolie, who has a weekly classic horror horror show. It's very much like what Zachary did many years ago.
Yes.
And Julie had mentioned Uncle Henry when they were showing Werewolf London, and they perpetuated unknowingly the erroneous story about the makeup, that Henry rejected the makeup because either he couldn't sit in the makeup chair long enough or it was for vanity purposes. And I wrote to Sven Gulli's show, and I explained to them that wasn't correct. And to their credit, when they showed the Wolfman about a month later, they corrected the whole story, and they told the true story that Henry Hull only objected to the makeup because it was completely covering his face. It was going to be very similar to what the Wolfman was later on. But the reason he objected was because in the script, two of the characters recognized him as being Dr. Glendon. And as he said, "How could they possibly recognize me as being Dr. Glendon when I was the werewolf, when I looked like Jack Pierce's teddy bear?" he really did object to it, and he wanted it toned down. Jack Pierce refused, and he had to go over Jack Pierce's head to Carl Laemmle, the head of the studio. He explained the situation. Laemmle agreed with him. He gave him he sent Jack Pierce a memo that it needed to be toned down. And the other thing that Uncle Henry kind of pushed for was the widow's peak, because he wanted it to have sort of a demonic look. And if you think about it, that widow's peak has been used in other werewolf films later, like, say, for instance, I Was a Teenage Werewolf, even Curse of the Werewolf, and yeah, little Eddie Munster in The Munsters, and even more recently in Teen Wolf, the MTV series that they did. It looks very much like the Henry Hull Werewolf of London. So unintentionally, Henry didn't realize it, but he kind of set the tone for a lot of other werewolf films to follow.
Awesome.
The sad thing is that Jack Pierce was livid, and you will never, ever find a photograph of him making up Uncle Henry as the Werewolf of London. That he was so angry, he would not allow any photographs of the two of them to be taken together. It's sad.
Yeah, absolutely. But I mean, going back to the Ripley's article, the previous article was, when was that published? Was that 60s or was that?
The original article that went out in Ripley's, that was in 1987. That's
1987.
87. And now they approached me again, and they wanted to do one on the 50th anniversary, which I was absolutely ecstatic about. I mean, to me, it's better than winning any award or anything else, because for one thing, this is international and it'll be in the Ripley's records. So, this is better than any award I could get, as far as I'm concerned. The other
Absolutely.
thing I should mention, which I have forgotten to mention, that the lighting and the sets, most all the sets in there were designed by Bill Diamond, who has worked with me diligently. And I feel terrible I didn't mention Bill. I mentioned him in relation to Gorgo, the gargoyle, because we did that together. But Bill and I worked together on this, and ever since it expanded, which is Dungeon, without Bill's help, it wouldn't have been possible. Bill Diamond does, well, he's won an Emmy for his day for lighting on TV,
Wow.
so he really knows his stuff. So he knows how to create the atmosphere that I want for this, and he also worked with me, and he designed the set. So he designed the new elaborate organ that we have for the Phantom, the castle facade for Count Dracula, and a number of other things. So,
And he was also involved, if I'm right, in the documentary, the Aurora Monsters documentary. Did he do the set design for that?
that's correct. Bill
Wow.
did the set design for the Aurora Monsters, and he also did a lot of the filming with me for the Phantom of the Opera, Unmasking the Masterpiece. So we've worked together on several projects, and so when you see this, the sets are just amazing. They're
Even the
really remarkable.
even the lighting on your documentary and the sequence with you as a kid, is really, really good. You know, that where it's just this very striking scene, and it's just got that nice ethereal quality. You know, the where there's the kid in your bedroom, and then it kind of pans out to the witch's dungeon.
Oh yeah.
I thought that looked fantastic.
When we did the Aurora Monsters documentary, I talked to Bill and I said, "You know what? I'd like to do the lighting as if it was like a cover of either Famous Monsters or James Bama's covers for the Aurora Monsters." And that's what we were going for. So that's why, if you notice in the Aurora Monsters documentary, the lighting that we used is very colorful.
So it's
It's
beautiful
atmospheric.
purples and greens and stuff.
Yeah, it's atmospheric, but yeah, you're right. It's got purples and greens and blues and see, this is what I loved about Hammer films. A lot of people don't think about it, but especially their night scenes, they had purples and blues, and they were using Technicolor to a great extent in their films. And that's what I love about the Hammer films, is because their use of color in those films is just remarkable. It still creates a mood and an atmosphere, but the colors are so beautiful that they use in those movies.
One of my great regrets, with regard to the Witch's Dungeon, I was due to come to the Witch's Dungeon in 2014, but unfortunately I was very ill and wasn't able to. So I was basically in New York, but could barely leave the house.
Yeah, I
And
remember.
the day that I was scheduled to be there, who else was there but one Basil Gogos?
Oh yes, that's right, because Basil came out to see it. Yeah. And we had a great time. He loved it.
So I absolutely missed out on a huge opportunity to meet an artist who uses those rich colors to bring out the true
And
horror of these characters.
that's what made me and Bill Diamond feel so good, because Basil recognized it when he went through. He says, "This is almost like one of my paintings." I said, "Exactly. That's what we were going for."
That's amazing. That's fantastic. Well, Cortland, listen, thank you so much for taking the time to speak to
Oh, I
us.
enjoy it.
It's been absolutely
And I
fantastic.
hope you guys can get out here someday, especially at least for now. We're in October, but let's keep our fingers crossed we get that elevator so that we can be open all year round.
Fingers
I would
crossed,
love
man.
to.
Fingers crossed. And people can go along to your website. Is it preservehollywood.org? You can see videos from the Witch's Dungeon, a whole range of pictures of the various characters that are portrayed, some of the backdrops and so on, and get a feel for what the dungeon originally looked like, and some pictures of the new and improved location. In the meantime, Cortland, just to say thank you so much indeed for being on Gavin Roscoe's Bodacious Horror Podcast, and wish you every success for the future.
Oh, I appreciate it, and I wish you guys could be here on Halloween night when we have Sarah Karloff here. It'd be a lot of fun.
Oh, that would just be my
Too
perfect
much.
Halloween.
So awesome. That's great. Thank you very, very much for taking the time.
Well, I appreciate it, and I hope all your listeners get a chance to visit
Well,
someday.
fingers crossed, man. Fingers crossed. And
Yeah.
as I say, I'm hoping that maybe next year we can get back out and see you.
That'd be fantastic. Always great to talk to you guys.
Thank you, man. Take care of yourself, Cortland.
And have a great 50th.
Have a brilliant Halloween.
Yep.
Yeah, happy Halloween to
Happy
both of you.
Halloween, man. See you later, Cortland, man.
Okay, bye-bye.
Take care, dude.
Bye.
Bye. Bye. Okay, guys, so that was Cortland Hull. That was again a great opportunity to speak to Cortland. And
I
yeah.
really want to go to this museum.
I know, I know.
I
It was
really, really want to go. Do
I
you
have
think
to
he'd let me hug the wolf, man?
I think the connect. Oh yeah, definitely would.
Would he?
I don't think so.
Oh.
Everything's put it behind glass. I we're
Do
just
you think
kind
he'd let me get behind the
of
glass?
quite possibly. So yeah, when I was there, it was in the original chalet building, and Cortland went to such an amazing effort. He came all the way to Hartford, Connecticut, picked me up from there, which is like half an hour's journey there and back, half an hour there, half an hour back. He picked me up, brought me back to his to the Witch's Dungeon, showed me around, got the Witch's Dungeon up and running, even though it was off season, had all of the lights on surrounding the whole thing, and it was just this incredible experience, and you know, just a I didn't really want to gush too much, but just a genuinely great person who went to such a great effort for me. And you know, I came home with a whole range of different posters that he gave me and DVDs and random stuff. And his house at that time was absolutely chock-a-block full of horror memorabilia. So like in his living room, he had like Lampini standing there and different things like that. So it was amazing, and it was just such a great experience. And I thought I'd, you know, give a wee bit of context. I'm slightly biased. I think the guy's amazing and such a great person. So it was really great to get the chance to catch up with Cortland. And I really do hope that we get to see the Witch's Dungeon again at some point in our lives.
Yeah,
So guys,
you can take your future wife.
well, possibly yes.
I will
So
take my future taller daughter.
absolutely. So the Witch's Dungeon is open weekends throughout October. excuse me. So,
Ross has a cold.
yes. So the Witch's Dungeon is open from 7 p.m. to 10 p.m. evenings all the way throughout October. So it's Friday through Sunday, and also the Witch's Dungeon is also open Halloween Day as well. $6 donation, which is absolutely nothing for what you're getting for your money. People who are interested, if you're interested in picking up a commemorative medallion of the Witch's Dungeon and the 50th anniversary, that's also available through preservehollywood.org, and all
And
of
they
that.
look awesome.
Yeah, and all of that goes towards the benefit of the Bristol Historical Society and the
You should
Witch's Dungeon.
tell people what is on these fantastic looking medallions.
Yeah, so one side of the medallion is Zenobia the Gypsy Witch, who is Cortland's character that we discussed during the interview, Cortland's first character design, and on the other side is Cortland's uncle, Henry Hull, as the Werewolf of London.
Yeah, they look great.
They look fantastic. So that's definitely a good way to support the Witch's Dungeon if you're not able to get out there. Cortland also mentioned that they're hoping to get the DVDs up and running again. So the three DVDs that are currently that have been produced are the Witch's Dungeon, the Aurora Monsters one, and the Phantom of the Opera one, which is Unmasking the Masterpiece. Only one of those is still in print, but if you've liked them on Facebook, then I'm sure you'll be able to see when those become available again.
And
So yeah.
you get to see some of Cortland's fantastic artwork, which we didn't talk too much about tonight,
We
but
done?
he does some fantastic pieces.
So Cortland's also done a whole range of work on a carousel as well, as a tribute to Rod Serling and Twilight Zone,
Yeah,
as well
picking
as
his
up.
favourite episodes.
She's done a whole lot of different, whole lot of different things like that. So yeah, totally support Cortland Hull and the Witch's Dungeon. Give them a like on Facebook and check out their website, preservehollywood.org. That's preservehollywood.org. I'm going to save my voice, guys, and cut it short tonight. Next week, we are going to have an interview with Frank Dellastretto, who we're very excited to talk to.
Well, we were, because we
We
already
were,
recorded that.
yes.
We've already told people
It's
that.
in the future. So yeah, we're speaking to Frank Dellastretto, and that He is the author of a book entitled I Saw What I Saw When I Saw It, which is about his personal experiences of growing up in the 50s and 60s and his interest in movies and film growing up from that. He's also written a book called Vampire Over London, Bela Lugosi in Britain, which is fantastic. We discussed that within the interview with Cortland, and you can get those books from Cult Movies Press. So we'll be talking to him next week.
Yep,
Is there
and
anything?
horror fans will recognise I saw what I saw when I saw it as a quote from Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein.
Absolutely. Okay, guys, we'll cut it short there. But thank you very much indeed for listening, and for putting up with my croaky voice.
I think it's gruff and sexy.
It's not easy being green, my friend. So, guys, thank you very much again for listening. As ever, you can find us on Facebook, Gillian Roscoe's Bodacious Horror Podcast. Alternatively, we're on Twitter. I am at Bodacious Horror. Gil, you are at.
Gil Rokitansky.
You certainly are. And you can email us.
I'm only kidding, I'm actually at Real Donald Trump.
Yeah, so tweet him. And tell him he's a Roddy Wimble. So. Guys, thank you very much indeed for listening. And once again, please don't have nightmares.
And here is our rare clip of Vincent Price.
Boom.
Okay, this is take one.
Welcome, poor mortal, to this witch's dungeon of nightmares. As you journey through these dark corridors, you will encounter all those ghoulies, ghosties, and long-legged beasties that go bump in the night. That's no good. I better do another one.